This week on Behind the Lens. A city contractor that authored a new report on short-term rentals has ties to Airbnb. Michael Isaac Stein has the story. And Marta Jusen talks to a mother who spent over a year waiting to have her child tested for special education and learned from the Louisiana Department of Education that New Orleans charter schools aren't required to provide programs for gifted students. Also, I'll talk to Marguerite Green, a progressive Democrat who's hoping to be Louisiana's next Commissioner of Agriculture. I'm Jessica Rosegard. You're listening to Behind the Lens, a podcast by The Lens.
Brought to you by community support. Learn more at support.thelensnola.org.
New Orleans City Council has been working to reform the city's short-term rental regulations for over a year. Many of the current council members were elected on promises to place stricter limits on short-term rentals in the city. Part of the reform deals with how commercial short-term rentals can be used to fund affordable housing. To that end, the city hired a contractor to put together a study with some recommendations. A draft of that study was recently shared with the city council. Michael Isaac Stein is here to talk about it. Michael, let's get right to the controversy. There are concerns that this contractor might have a conflict of interest.
Yeah, so it came out that this company that wrote what was supposed to be an objective report on how commercial short-term rentals could be leveraged to create affordable housing, turns out that they have worked for Airbnb several times creating these economic impact reports in cities like New York and San Francisco, these kind of glowing reports about job creation and benefits to the local economy. And, you know, it was apparently something that the city council was not aware of. Councilwoman Kristen Palmer sent out a press release saying that the council had not been made aware of this past work and that it raised questions about their impartiality. And you know, some housing advocates I spoke to mentioned that even outside of Airbnb, they represent a wide swath of, you know, different interests in the real estate industry, including large developers and things of that sort. So I guess the question here is whether this company can be truly impartial in creating a report about how to regulate short-term rentals.
You mentioned Councilwoman Palmer. She's been an advocate of using short-term rentals to help fund affordable housing. What's her proposal?
So her proposal, it's been probably the most aggressive one put forward, and basically she said that in large commercial buildings, so some of these big apartment buildings you see in the CBD, for example, for every short-term rental that they have, they should have to add one unit of affordable housing. She's also recommended putting a cap on how much of a single building can be taken up by short-term rentals, and so she's suggested a cap of 25% of any building. And she's also discussed maybe creating some sort of incentive program to allow buildings to exceed that 25% cap, possibly with fees that would go into a fund for affordable housing.
And the draft study that was released disagrees with that proposal by Councilwoman Palmer. What's the disagreement?
We should probably go back. This is the second study that this company has done for the city. It was originally hired to study the mandatory inclusionary zoning ordinance. And just to give a quick background there, what that is, a mandatory inclusionary zoning policy, basically it says in new developments, it mandates that in new developments, a certain number of the units in those buildings have to be affordable to, you know, and that definition is obviously important in that, but generally more affordable than market rate. And oftentimes that comes with certain incentives like tax incentives and so forth. So when they came forward with a study on how feasible it was to implement that policy in New Orleans, there was an interesting moment. So they were presenting it to the city council, and Councilwoman Palmer said, well, I'm not hearing anything about commercial short-term rentals. She was basically saying that, you know, in something like this, you know, commercial short-term rentals are a pretty powerful incentive tool. And what HRNA Associates said is, you know, we just did not look at that. Anyway, they were hired again to do this more recent study on commercial short-term rentals and affordable housing. And their recommendations were a lot more modest than what Palmer's been talking about. They said if the city wants to do a unit-for-unit match, the only feasible way to do that would be one affordable housing unit for every 6 short-term rental units. And even by their own calculations, that would only produce 57 affordable housing units, which to some housing advocates is an unacceptably low number. Ultimately, what they're recommending is some sort of nightly fee, so either an $8 or $10 nightly fee for commercial short-term rentals that would go into an affordable housing fund.
Yeah, there's a huge difference there between Palmer's 1-to-1 recommendation and a 1-to-6 recommendation from HRNA. Obviously, there seems to be a lot of middle ground between 1-to-1 and 1-to-6. Has there been any discussion about more of a 50-50, like a 1-to-3 sort of arrangement?
Not yet. The council hasn't really, the report became public when it was reported by the Times-Picayune New Orleans Advocate. It's a draft study that was sent out to the council, so it hasn't really even been publicly discussed yet. Next week, on August 8th, they'll be voting on 2 central ordinances in the short-term rental reform effort, and it's possible they'll talk about it then. But I should mention, this company does have a history with Airbnb, but also if you read the report, which we have published on our website, they do give some logical reasons for coming to that conclusion, basically saying that anything more than what they suggested would discourage development at all. So, thus defeating the point of using new development to get affordable housing. So there is definitely a lot. They're taking an approach that tries to balance the city's desire to create more affordable housing and developers' profit incentives. But I think the critique from housing advocates is that they took developers' needs a little bit, they maybe put a little bit more weight behind that than on the affordable housing crisis in the city.
Given the controversy that we talked about at the beginning, knowing what the city council now knows about HRNA and their past business with Airbnb, can this report be useful? Can these recommendations be taken by the city council, with a grain of salt?
I think that's up to the council. As Palmer said, she indicated that she herself is having some doubts about the findings in the report. I think there's still some useful information in there, so some objective numbers on, what developments to expect in the next couple of years, what neighborhoods have stronger markets versus others. It's going to be up to the council whether they think that, the city's housing market can't take any more than a 1-to-6 match or a $10 a night fee.
And you said that this will all be discussed at the next regular meeting of the City Council on August 8th. Can you give me a quick rundown or overview of the issues, any issues dealing with short-term rentals that will be discussed at that meeting?
Yes, so they'll be looking at 2 ordinances. The first is kind of the major, major overhaul of how short-term rentals are regulated in the city. So here it's creating an entirely new permitting system, getting rid of what was once the most popular permit, the temporary residential permit. So a lot of big changes in that ordinance coming to residential short-term rentals, really putting a lot of restrictions there. That's one of the ordinances. And then the other is kind of more of an enforcement piece. It creates a new permitting system for platforms like Airbnb or operators like Sonder or Stay Heirloom, who don't actually own the properties, but will run them as short-term rentals on behalf of the owner for a fee or something like that. So basically, that is trying to add new accountability measures. So, a company like Airbnb will have to get a permit. And if they continue listing unpermitted homes, for example, they could have their permit revoked. So that one is, and that's just one example of what's in that ordinance. But again, yeah, you have one that's creating a new permit structure and the other that's kind of focused more on making sure that structure is actually followed.
Michael Isaac Stein, thank you so much for keeping us up to date on all of these developments regarding short-term rentals in New Orleans.
No, thank you.
When second grader Ava Cruz told her mother, Allison, that she was being pulled out of class at Morris Jeff Community School for extra help, Allison requested to have Ava tested for gifted programming and special education. The process took over a year. The Lens education reporter, Marta Jusen, sat down with Allison Cruz to talk about the hurdles she faced getting Ava tested.
So can you talk about how you feel after the meeting today? you finally got to sit down after 400 days and get some answers, although You only began working with Ms. Smith, who was testing Ava a couple months ago. Mm-hmm. You've been trying to get a test for over a year.
I feel relieved. The parts of the process that we were able to get through seemed very systematic and orderly and easy to understand. And so I just feel really relieved. And I feel really gratified that she did come out with the designation in the end. But I mean, I truly believe that if she hadn't gotten the designation, then it just would have been the end of the process. But because I trust those two evaluators. But mostly I just feel really just a lot of relief.
And can you briefly summarize how it all started?
Yes. My daughter, who was in the end of second grade at the time, came home from school and noted that she and another little friend from her class, who I knew had a gifted IEP, were getting pulled out of their class for extra work by Lisa Sergo, who is the school's gifted and talented and other special ed. I don't even truly know what her job is. They were getting pulled out of class to have extra work done, which just made me wonder what they were doing together, since I knew one was gifted and one was not, technically. And I sent her an email. They sent Lisa Sergo an email asking what she was doing, like why they were being pulled out of class, and if Ava possibly could be gifted, if that's something that I should explore. And I was just looking for her professional opinion on that. And it took 4 weeks for her to respond. I had to follow up once, and then I had to follow up again. And by that time, we had gotten to the very end of the school year. And at the end of the school year, she said that I needed to email at the beginning of the following year, which brought us to third grade. And that started a year-long process of emails back and forth, of us being coached by friends who were special educators in the city, who were, also worked at public charter schools, and also having then a private psychologist involved for my other child who was coaching us through the process. And then finally Ava did get screened and evaluated the week after her third grade year ended. A whole summer went by before we got the results. Now she starts school on Monday. And so we finally got the results after me sending the initial email at the end of her second grade year.
Yeah, so it's been more than a year. It's been a heavily involved process. I'm sure very labor-intensive, both emotionally and physically, just having to run around. And now you finally got some answers, and you actually learned something pretty surprising in the process, which came back in the form of a response to a formal complaint that you filed because it had taken so long to get Ava tested.
Yes. So the two special educators that we know personally from life let us know that the school was held accountable to state and federal laws regarding timelines for special education screening and evaluation, and that once a parent has requested that a child be screened for the gifted and talented designation specifically, because that's what was happening in our case, that the school had 60 days to respond to that request. Once we got that coaching from our friends, I started making explicit requests in email saying, I want Ava to be gifted tested. I don't agree with what you're saying, and I want her to be gifted tested now. I don't want to wait. I want her to be gifted tested now. And that happened 8 times. And so lots and lots of back and forth that ended with me being very frustrated. And so I was able, fortunately, to get in touch with somebody at the Louisiana Department of Education who works with all of the gifted and talented designations. And that person, who again, who works at the state in Baton Rouge, let me know that I had grounds for a systemic complaint against the school because it had taken so long and they weren't following the timelines that they were supposed to be held accountable to. So based on that person's recommendation and the link that that person sent me to fill out the complaint form, I did. I filled out all of the paperwork. I sent copies of all of our email exchanges, including one where I had a timeline, a succinct timeline of all of the emails and their contents. And within 24 hours, it seemed, I got a response back from the state's lawyer saying that, in fact, the school is exempt from those state laws because of their public charter status, which was shocking because nobody, including the woman who worked at the state or any of the special educators at the school or special educator friends who were coaching us, knew that. And so if maybe we had known that way in the beginning, my process for pushing forward would have definitely been totally different.
I'm sure. I mean, that's something that I learned too in this process and learned from you. It's not something that I was aware of before. And I think it's particularly interesting now that we're literally just 1 month into an all charter district. So technically that means unless it's written into any of the charters in the city, into their contracts and operating agreements, that it sounds like they don't have to offer gifted services. Now, I'm sure there are charters that are offering them to different extents, but it's going to be an interesting process for parents going forward.
It's definitely going to be interesting for me because now we've gotten the designation. Now we have to move forward with actually two of our kids. We're extremely fortunate. Two of our kids getting their IEPs and getting their plans worked out or whatnot. But I'm really unclear about what the school actually has to do if they're exempt from these laws. Because throughout this process, we were presented with all this paperwork that had timelines and very jargon language on it. And it all seemed very official. Like, we're following guide bulletin 1508 and following these timelines. And I have 60 days to respond. And I have this many days to respond. And you think, like, okay, I'm being protected by this process that helps push the process along. And that's why the school wasn't responding. But they don't have to. And so what do they have to do at all? And I don't even know. And it doesn't sound like anybody really knows what they have to do.
I know one of your other concerns throughout this process was advantage and ability to be able to, you know, follow through and have everything from resources, time included, to be able to make this testing happen. I mean, that's, I think, the reason you came to me in the first place. Mm-hmm. Do you want to elaborate on your thoughts on that at all?
Yes. So our family has every advantage. My husband and I are both highly educated. We speak English. We have white privilege. We have every privilege. Like, I have a job where I'm able to jump on my email whenever I need to. I can jump in my car. I have my own transportation. I can just run into my boss's office and say, hey, get a dash out for a little bit and run to the school. And I mean, that's really what it takes. And so it was just so shocking to me that it was so hard, because if I didn't have all of those advantages or the lack of fear to push back or to make people angry, because I'm not afraid of retaliation, I feel like that's how we got to this endpoint. And I think that it's not fair that to get your children basic educational services in the city, that's what it has to come to. And one of the things that really pushed me to look further into this was my son, who turns out, again, is gifted, which we were surprised by. He's a smart little boy, and I just love him so much. But we would have just gone through him being in school not pursuing this at all. And he had behavioral problems at school and got pulled into the IEP testing process because he was having a lot of behavioral problems. And my husband and I were just like willing to do anything. Like, who do we need to talk to? What help do we need to get? We want him to be successful. We don't want him to disrupt other people's educational processes. And in the process of him getting tested for his behavioral problems, somebody happened to take note that he may be gifted and added that step to his IEP testing process. And it turns out, lo and behold, that he is also gifted. And now he has two designations. He has the first for other health impairments, and then the second is the gifted and talented designation. And just seeing him go through the process for his behavioral disorder and also end up being gifted made me realize, especially, wow, how many other kids whose families can't take up for them without fear of retaliation or the freedom to just like dash out of work in the middle of the day might also be gifted and need extra positive attention at school that they're not getting because nobody took up for them, or they didn't have private psychologists or friends who were able to coach them, you know. And I believe in public education. I believe in equity for children. And I think that educating kids makes all of us better. It's a public good. And so I reject that it has to be so challenging to educate your children in a public environment. I just reject that flat out.
That was Lens reporter Marta Jusen speaking with local parent Allison Cruz, who has two students in New Orleans charter schools. You can read Marta's story online next week at thelensnola.org. Marguerite Green didn't grow up in a farming family, but she developed a love for agriculture as a student at LSU. Now she's running as a progressive Democrat, hoping to unseat Mike Strain as Louisiana's Commissioner of Agriculture. I sat down to talk with Marguerite about her experience and her thoughts on the future of agriculture. Marguerite, tell me a bit about your background. How did you get involved in farming?
Yeah, so I started out at LSU as an art major, actually, and took a non-credit course in organic farming. And I immediately was both taken with it, and I felt more kind of centered and calm and happier than I had ever felt. And I also was surprised that that was a thing that people do for a living. And so I pretty immediately immersed myself fully into it. It was kind of the classic thing where if you find what you love, you can kind of just like dive straight in. And I would say within a year's time, I became a person whose sort of identity was wrapped in being a grower of food.
Farming seems to be one of those things, you know. I think the stereotype is that you learn it through your family, that you come up through a farming family, living on a farm, and that's how that becomes your life's work. So you came at this a very different way. What are your values when it comes to farming?
So I really quickly want to say that I love that you pointed that out, that a lot of people traditionally come to farming through family. And sorry to hijack the question, but one of the things is that we're seeing is that that's happening less and less. And we know that farmers who are 35 and younger are outnumbered by farmers who are 65 and older by 6-1. And that means all of that farmland that we have that needs to transition hands doesn't really have young people for it to go to, because we see a lot of people leaving the farm, a lot of young people leaving the farm. We need to be training first-generation farmers, and I think that's an important part of this conversation. I saw that window to make sure that we're talking about that. But my values as a farmer are that at any given moment I'm remembering that I'm a steward of the earth, and that I believe we can reconcile having the earth do what we need it to do, whether that's raising animals or food, and then also being thankful for what we get from it and being protective and regenerative of it. So we've created a system of agriculture that is oftentimes incentivizes us actually hurting the earth. And I think that there are a lot of people who would like us to believe that that's the only way we can feed everyone. And the answer is that's just not true. So I don't, I'm not certified organic. I don't encourage people to pursue certification, but I do encourage people to be being mindful of what kind of pesticides and fertilizers they're using and what the practices that they're using on their land is. There are a lot of certifications that people can get, and I think that's one of the problems is we've got kind of a labeling nightmare out there in the world. Farmers know land best, right? Like, farmers know nature through work. And so telling a farmer what to do because of a label is a difficult thing for me to understand. Telling a farmer what to do that's best for their land makes more sense to me. And oftentimes that's not profitable. And so I think we need to be moving towards a system where we can incentivize people taking care of the earth and making food at the same time.
Yeah, and I realized looking at your website and reading up about you a bit, you do come from this approach of perhaps exporting maybe less and providing closer to home, which has been a growing trend in recent years of, you know, farm-to-table restaurants and restaurants that will tell you how locally they're sourcing their ingredients. How does that fit into the bigger picture of agriculture in Louisiana right now?
Yeah, that's a great question. So one of the things when we're talking about that abundance of food that exists is that we can look at trends in data and know that that food won't continue to exist because the amount that we're importing and exporting food-wise is unsustainable in a warming world. Because of climate change, we're going to have food insecurity and water issues that are popping up all over the country. Louisiana's on the front line of that. And we're not going to be able to build infrastructure to feed our communities and build out new farms to feed our communities under that level of, you know, panic and duress. We need to start doing it now, because actually doing it that way can slow climate change, right? It's not just one of the things that I like to think about is climate change isn't a binary. It doesn't happen or not happen, right? So we're trying to slow things. We're trying to fix things. We're not going to be able to stop things. And so if we can start building systems that don't contribute as much to global warming and help feed our communities in the face of global warming, then that's an actual, that's a true form of resiliency. So I think asking people to plan for a future that we don't see yet is difficult, but that is the necessity of trying to have more domestic food production.
I think that there's a certain population of people that are on board with your position and your message and your ideas. There's another population that I think is probably not, especially if you want to break it down between Democrats and Republicans in the state of Louisiana. Is that where you're trying to sort of get in and disrupt the status quo, if I could say that's what you're trying to do, with this new generation of farmers as opposed to convincing an older generation?
That's an interesting question. So one of the things that I think is cool about getting to run an agriculture race and talk about climate change is that regardless of party lines, and I think for the most part, regardless of where you are in the state of Louisiana, even though I have heard a lot of people say, you know, anyone above I-10 isn't going to worry about coastal erosion, well, the truth of that is that all of our southern communities are just going to have to move up there, so they should care. But that there's a bigger picture is that farmers, whatever their age, know that something is happening. Whether they're in a place to say, oh, it's man-made climate change, which we know is absolutely scientifically, there's a consensus, or they're saying, okay, I'm willing to talk. There's something happening, I don't know what it is or why it's happening, but farmers have their hand in the dirt every day. And I know in my short lifetime of growing, you know, I've grown food for just over a decade, that I used to not have irrigation in South Louisiana. Now we have intense periods of drought alongside intense periods of rain. So my ability to grow food has changed in my lifetime, which means older folks who have been doing this for a long time, they know something is up, and that is why I think an agriculture race is the place to talk across difference. And then you also see people who are understanding that while it's a lot harder work, it just objectively is, to grow diversified vegetable crops than it is to grow row crops that you can harvest mechanically, that those row crops make somewhere between $600 and $800 an acre, whereas vegetables can make up to $60,000 an acre. I don't want to undersell how hard that is and how much work goes into that and how much capital goes into that, but we can also start to work with those producers who are relying on subsidies to help them transition 100 acres, 10 acres, into vegetable crops so that they're building sustainability in their business and they're building food security for our state.
Right, because sustainability doesn't just mean food and farming and use of the earth, but it means in terms of a farmer's business. Slightly turning from subsidies, we've got this trade war with China that has really been impacting Louisiana farmers. Current Agriculture Commissioner Mike Strain said about a year ago when this trade war started that farmers would suffer, but in the long run would be worth it. Those farmers have also received subsidies from the government. What's your feeling on whether or not subsidies should exist, whether or not they need to, and the state of the trade war?
Yeah, thanks for asking that, because I think that if I remember correctly, Strain also had a quote that there was a bigger purpose to this. And I think what we can see this far out is that if there's a bigger purpose, then we need to be alerted to what it is, because even those farmers that are receiving subsidies, it's not the hardworking row crop like farmers that are receiving most of those subsidies. We have farmers who aren't even farming. And when I say aren't farming, I mean they're not planting, they're not harvesting. Those people are getting subsidy payouts. And also, those subsidy payouts are coming from taxpayers. And time again, economists are looking at it and they're saying, you know, whoever's saying that these payouts are coming from China is wrong. They are absolutely coming out of taxpayers' pockets. And the point of this is that the subsidy system's completely broken, right? But it is not the fault of the farmers who rely on it. And that's something I've been thinking about a lot, is that when you are raised into a system that operates this way, you're going to do your best to operate within it. And that's why I really think we need help in transitioning. If we're going to subsidize something in this country, we should be subsidizing what we actually need, which is food. We can help transition all of those farmers to things like sustainable grain production, for like heritage grain mills that are popping up all across our country. There are millions of ways that we can actually help people transition their row crops to something that's better for our environment and our communities and doesn't hurt their bottom line. And if anything has come of this trade war, I think it's that we've had a system that's been propped up for so long. And this trade war has hurt so many farmers and is continuing to hurt so many farmers who are having a hard time crossing party lines and actually being as mad at Donald Trump as I believe that they rightfully should be. I kind of joke that I'm like willing to be mad for them, even if they're not willing to be mad for them. What it's shown is that the system is such a house of cards. And I hope that maybe this can be the push of saying we can't go back to that broken system. This has been so messed up because of a trade war that this is the time to fix it.
Another topic that comes up in the state, certainly every month when Governor John Bel Edwards sits down for Ask the Governor, is the question of marijuana in Louisiana. What is your position on the state of cannabis in the state?
I am the candidate for recreational cannabis, also known as adult access cannabis. I want full legality for adults to responsibly use cannabis in the state. I think it's important from a lot of different perspectives, but I think that one of the things that sort of gets lost in the conversation is that our medical cannabis system, which is, I talk about a lot of systems being broken, but it's because a lot of systems are broken. Our medical cannabis system here in Louisiana is laid out so that we will never have profit for farmers. Farmers won't ever get the right to grow that crop. Industrial hemp, yes, but I am worried about how many hoops people are going to have to jump through to get the right to grow. But as far as cannabis flower for medical purposes, right now we have two companies that have the licenses to grow those through our state. It's a really unusual system. There's not another state that has a system like ours where the state itself is in charge of regulation and growing. I'm concerned about that consolidation of power. And I also think a really big thing to hammer home is that if we just stick to a medical program, we won't have the budget surplus that our state needs to do all of the coastal revegetation that we have to do to save this state. And when people ask that question of, you know, the question always comes up, how are you going to pay for it? I think there are a lot of ways to pay for the things that we have to do or we lose our land. But the best one seems to be cannabis to me. It also is important because the difference between medical and recreation is that if we still have a system where cannabis is criminalized, then we'll still continue to criminalize communities, underserved communities, specifically Black and Brown communities, which we know have a higher arrest rate, they're policed more highly than white communities that use the same amount of cannabis. And if we're not able to have a criminal justice reform component of our cannabis program in this state, then what we're doing is we're doubling down on hundreds of years of inequity. And I think that this is the moment where we can say it's better for our state financially. It's better for like the incarceration rates of people in our state. And we can work on auto expungement of records so that we don't have a product that's legal now and we're still criminalizing people who've used it in the past. I also think we're definitely going to have federal legality at some point. And if we just wait on that, then our state will stand to make no money.
It seems to me that your approach to a lot of these issues comes from a very holistic place in the sense that it's not just the farm industry existing in a vacuum, that it's tied to the earth and the climate and the environment and the coast and the business of it.
Yeah, I appreciate you seeing that. I mean, when I talk about my platform, I sometimes get overwhelmed at how much I want to show how interconnected all of these things are. And it's not because we've done work to try to weave these stories together. It's because the story of land and environment and growing and feeding people and taking care of each other and our communities is so interwoven. And it is, I mean, it all goes back to the same history of people working with the earth to make cities. And so that's why when we hurt one thing, we hurt another. And the only way for us to boost up one thing is to boost up another.
That was Marguerite Green, candidate for Commissioner of Agriculture in Louisiana. That's it for this week. Thanks for listening to Behind the Lens. I'm your host, Jessica Rosegard. We'll be back next week. In the meantime, please consider supporting independent journalism in New Orleans. Go to support.thelensnola.org and make a donation today.